From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a preview of David Lynch's new movie, Wild at Heart, from the movie's star, Nicolas Cage. Cage also starred in Raising Arizona and Moonstruck. Also, we meet actor Bruno Kirby. If you don't recognize his name, you'll probably recognize his voice. He was a self-righteous officer in Good Morning Vietnam and Billy Crystal's best friend in When Harry Met Sally. He's now co-starring in The Freshman with Marlon Brando and Matthew Broderick. World music commentator Milo Miles begins a two-part series on music of the islands of Trinidad and Tobago. And film critic Owen Gleiberman watches Jimmy Stewart in Harvey. It's now out on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate passed a 1990 farm bill today that makes no major changes in farm subsidy programs, but does establish new programs to protect the environment. The Senate bill would spend $55 billion on farm supports. The bill could face opposition from the White House, which has warned it might veto a farm bill that doesn't include substantial cost cuts from the current level. The bill passed on a vote of 70-21 after compromises on scores of amendments. Senate leaders decided to delay cuts until Congress and the Bush administration agree on overall budget cuts. Budget negotiators are taking a break from their meetings this weekend after failing to come up with a plan for reducing the federal deficit. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The negotiators met four times in as many days this week at the White House, but have yet to present formal proposals for discussion. The Bush administration has floated two of its proposals. One would limit to $10,000 the amount of state and local taxes taxpayers could deduct from their federal returns. The plan has drawn fire from some state and local officials who say it won't affect taxpayers in states where there are no state income taxes. Nevertheless, House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt of Missouri declined to discuss the proposal today.
I prefer not to comment on these proposals. Everything's on the table, and they're all ideas that we have to look at.
Another administration proposal would increase taxes on beer and wine. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Rebels in Liberia are claiming victory. In a Liberian radio broadcast monitored today in London, rebel leader Charles Taylor announced that he had taken control of the country and said the government of President Samuel Doe has been replaced. The parliament in the Western Soviet Republic of Belarusia has become the latest in the country to declare declaration of sovereignty. As the BBC's Kevin Connolly reports, the decision sets the republic on a path already followed by others.
More than half of the Soviet republics, including all of the richest and most powerful, have now passed declarations demanding in one form or another a much greater degree of political freedom. The parliament of Belarusia voted simply to declare the republic a sovereign state. But as more and more assemblies around the Soviet Union take similar steps, it's becoming increasingly difficult to work out exactly what sort of relationship they'll have in the future, and indeed what sort of relationship they have now with Moscow. Mr. Gorbachev has in any case indicated that he's ready to grant all 15 republics a much greater degree of autonomy than they've enjoyed in the past under the terms of a treaty of union, which will establish a new relationship between them and the center.
Kevin Connolly of the BBC. Stock prices fell today on Wall Street, pushed down by news that the gross national product grew at a sluggish rate of only 1.2% in the second quarter of the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 22 points to close at 2,898.5. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The summer movie everyone seems to be waiting for is David Lynch's Wild at Heart. My guest Nicolas Cage is the star. Cage starred opposite Cher in Moonstruck and Kathleen Turner in Peggy Sue Got Married. He played an ex-con who kidnaps a baby to keep his marriage together in Raising Arizona. He's a Vietnam veteran in Birdie and a literary agent who's convinced he's turning into Nosferatu in Vampire's Kiss. Cage also appeared in The Cotton Club and Rumblefish. Although Nicolas Cage often plays ex-cons and working-class characters, his real background is quite different. His father is the Dean of Creative Arts at San Francisco State University, and his uncle is film director Francis Ford Coppola. In Wild at Heart, Cage plays Sailor, an ex-con obsessively in love with Lula, who's played by Laura Dern. They're traveling through the South to get away from her crazy mother, who's forbidden their relationship.
Basically, the relationship is just a very intense thing of love. And everything that Sailor does is because of Lula. And he'll do anything for her. He'll beg, he'll steal, he would even kill. And so in that sense, he's kind of a radical character, but because of the idea that it's motivated from his love for her, there is something a little sympathetic about it.
This is not the first time you've played an ex-con. Did that have anything to do with David Lynch wanting you for the movie?
Oh, I don't know. I know that he likes Raising Arizona and he likes the Coen brothers. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, though. I ran into David a couple of times. Once I ran into him at Thrifty Drug and Discount Store, and I was looking for some cold medication for my girlfriend at the time, and he said hello, and then I ran into him at an old restaurant here in Hollywood called Musso and Frank's Bar and Grill, and he said, Nick, and I turned around, and there was David Lynch, and I thought he was Jimmy Stewart, and he looks a hell of a lot like Jimmy Stewart, and after that, you know, I heard about the book Wild at Heart and that he wanted me to read it, and we talked about possibly making it into a movie, and it all came together.
Lynch's movies, like Blue Velvet, for instance, have a real dream quality to them. They're not exactly realistic. I assume there's that kind of dream quality in Wild at Heart, and if so, what kind of opportunity does that give you as an actor to do things that are beyond realism?
Well, you know, I think that the dream state is a wonderful playground, and it gives an actor license to do just about anything, which is a hell of a lot of fun for me, because I was starting to feel kind of stagnated and kind of just locked into this whole naturalism thing. And I started looking for scripts such as Vampire's Kiss, which a lot of it happens in the hallucinatory state or the psychotic dream state, and Peggy Sue Got Married, which also was sort of a dream state, if you will, from Kathleen Turner's point of view. And then David, who has this very specific world that he creates, is almost always in that kind of higher reality, if you will, kind of dream state. So it's a very liberating thing to be able to work in that kind of a format. The problem with it, though, is that there are very few movies which allow for that kind of behavior, to basically let go and try new things. So, you know, you have to sort of go back to your roots or naturalism, if you will.
Can you give us a sense of some of the more adventurous things that you tried in your role as Sailor?
Well, you know, the biggest adventure for me was that I had to sing, and I'm not a singer, and I only sang once before, and that was in Peggy Sue Got Married, and the character wasn't supposed to sing very well, so I wasn't too nervous about it. But David is a huge lover of music, and he wanted me to sing two Elvis songs. And at best, my singing sounds like a barking dog, so I was pretty nervous. And I think that was a little bit of an adventure right there, to be able to pull that together with him.
One of the songs is Love Me Tender, right?
Right.
So
and the other one is Love Me.
So how do you do it? Are you supposed to be impersonating Elvis, or?
Well, the thing about Sailor is he does sort of have this adopted Elvis essence to him, and I David really wanted that to come through with the character. It's kind of a chancy thing, you know, because people might look at it and say, oh, that's a caricature of Elvis Presley, but actually it's more of a tone thing, if you will, you know, kind of an idea, a mood. And so I went ahead and sort of adopted some of Elvis Presley's mannerisms and vocal intonations.
Which mannerisms did you pick up on?
Well, you know, kind of like all that, how you doing, baby? Keep them white panties on.
Did you go back and watch early Elvis movies?
Yeah, I watched a lot of the This Is Elvis movie, which had some excellent clips of just the way he was when he was hanging out alone and talking and I watched some of the beach blanket bingo type movies that he made, and the guy was really a fascinating personality, so I had a lot of fun borrowing from him.
Blue Velvet, for instance, had some very disturbing images in it, and I've been hearing from people who've screened Wild at Heart that there's some very disturbing images in it. I'm wondering what those images are, and if you are aware of that when you're in it, or if you actually have to see the film back to understand visually what's happening in it.
Well, you know, that's a good question, because during the whole making of the movie, David's process with the actors, with everybody, the set people and the designers, is very positive and up and fun spirited. So here's a bunch of people having a hell of a good time working together, and then you see the movie and there's some moments that are truly terrifying. And I wonder how those moments were spawned out of such kind of a jolly time.
What's one of those moments?
Well, there's a moment in the movie where Harry Dean Stanton gets his head blown off. That is, it just smells like black magic and ritual, and it's pretty scary.
Nicolas Cage is my guest, and he's starring in David Lynch's new movie, Wild at Heart, which opens August 17th. Is it a true story that when you were doing the film Birdie, and this was in the early part of the 1980s, that you pulled two teeth as part of your getting into the role?
Well, actually what happened was I had baby teeth up until I was 22.
Oh.
And they wouldn't come out, so by coincidence, simultaneously, I had to pull the teeth out while I was making Birdie so that the other teeth would come in because they were getting impacted. And I guess people just thought it was some example of wacko method,
right,
you know, masochism, which it really wasn't.
Nevertheless, did it help you in the role to experience so much pain?
Well,
I think that's what
actually,
people assumed it was
figured,
for. Yeah.
I figured as long as it's here, might as well use it, you know.
So how did you use it? What does that mean?
Well, if you're experiencing dental pain while you're doing a scene where your face has been blown off, just basically you don't have to act. Just use the dental pain.
Can you tell when you watch the movie back that you were experiencing real pain?
Yeah. Yeah, I can. I don't actually like to watch that movie, to tell you the truth.
Because you don't like the movie?
No, I like the movie. It's just that It was like it was a little private, you know. I let so much stuff come out, and I get a little embarrassed when I see it, just because it's just so bare.
Have you ever gone to real extremes, the equivalent of pulling teeth, to get into a role?
Yeah, I mean, I had to learn while I was working, and learn publicly through trial and error, and sometimes I fell on my face and sometimes it worked, but I started at a pretty early age. I started when I was 17, and I really didn't have that much training. So I basically just did all the things that I'd heard the other great actors had done, like staying up all night to do a scene the next day to look tired, or really doing the method thing. And on Cotton Club, I was playing a pretty crazy gangster who was very feared in Harlem. And I would walk down the street in New York and, you know, smash people's remote control cars and have everything scatter and, you know, really believe I was this psychotic killer. And by the time I was about to do the scene the next day, I brought all that stuff to the scene and it worked. But, you know, needless to say, I wasn't liked very much. And I mean, I do have a life and I don't really want to live the part anymore. So I stopped doing that, and I realized I could get there without all that intense living the role kind of thing.
So what did you do? You smashed remote control cars?
Well, I went down Christopher Street, and there was a guy selling remote control cars for $50, and I said, let me see that, and I put it in the middle of the street, and I jumped on and smashed it, and all the pieces were flying around, all the people just scattered and saying, oh, you're crazy, and all this, and I did give the guy $50 for it, but it just sort of helped me believe that I could create fear in people, which is what that character did in the movie.
You had no confidence that you were really capable of generating fear in somebody before that?
Well, it felt like I was able to, you know. I'm really not a violent guy. I'm not a fighter. I'm not into that. But when I was playing that role, at least at that point, I was young and I was just experimenting with trying to evoke that so that I could believe it in myself or the character. I've learned that it's just not necessary, and it's actually a lot more creative and thoughtful to just, you know, act the role a little bit sometimes.
Have you ever tried something pretty outrageous in a role and had a director object to it and say that's too far out?
Yeah. I was doing Racing with the Moon, and I've always had this idea of breaking the fourth wall, which is like taking it into hyperrealism, which is what I did in Vampire's Kiss, actually, when I ate the cockroach. I wanted people to know that it was really happening and to get into that and create that sort of visceral aura. And, in Racing with the Moon, I took a pocket knife out and I basically cut my arm open and wanted the blood to go and flow on film and have people know it was a very realistic moment. And Richard Benjamin basically said, wrong movie, Nick. Let's cool out a little.
So did he want you to use fake blood, or did he not like that whole idea of self-mutilation anyways?
He just didn't like the idea at all. It wasn't even in the script.
I just wanted to do this one thing,
you know, and try to do something hyper-real. I was experimenting with a lot of different things back then, and I'm glad I did it and went through it, but I do feel like now it's a little bit easier for me to arrive at what is needed in the scene emotionally or in terms of character without doing that intense, self-destructive kind of acting.
Well, we'll get back to that cockroach you ate in a couple of minutes. But first, let's take a short break. My guest is Nicolas Cage, and he's starring in David Lynch's new movie, Wild at Heart. And we'll talk about some of his other movies after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Nicolas Cage is my guest, and his movies include Moonstruck, Raising Arizona, Peggy Sue Got Married, Cotton Club, and Vampire's Kiss. Let's talk a little bit about Vampire's Kiss. This is the movie that you referred to before, that you ate the cockroach in. This is a wonderful film. You play a character who is a very obnoxious literary agent, and he thinks he's turning into a vampire because he's gone to bed with someone who he believes bit him, you know, a vampire, a
right.
Female vampire who he believes bit him. And he starts, you know, shrinking at the sign of the cross and asking people to put a stake through his heart to take him out of his misery. It's an incredibly original performance that you give. It just seemed to me like you must have watched all the new and old horror films to get the classic vampire gestures for the movie.
Well, you know, that's true, actually. I was exposed to the movie Nosferatu at a very early age because my father was teaching film. And the original Nosferatu, starring Max Schreck, the black and white silent vampire movie, gave me nightmares for years. And those images, especially his body language and his gestures and movements, stayed with me, and I always thought it'd be great to be able to incorporate that kind of silent film acting where they were using their bodies more because they had to compensate for the lack of sound and try to bring it into modern film. And with Vampire's Kiss, I saw an opportunity to do that, kind of explore that German expressionist style of acting that those guys were doing back then, like in Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and even Emil Jannings. And the only way I could pull it off, I figured, was if the character was insane. because you can't really act like that in modern film in a normal format, because people just wouldn't understand or get it or relate to it or want to relate to it. But if the character is insane, and especially if he thinks he's turning into a vampire, there's just a wonderful landscape of things you can do. And so I brought those old style gestures to the character because of his insanity, basically.
Well, one example of the kind of really large gesture that you're talking about is a widening of the eyes. I mean, your eyes get huge in one of the scenes. Did you know you had the capacity to do that with your face?
Well, I experimented in front of a mirror. You know, see, that was what Max Schreck was doing in Nosferatu. His eyes were really wide, and he was just spooky. And I figured it would be kind of cool in one scene to try to freak the secretary, Alva, played by Maria Conchita Alonso, freak her out instead of yelling at her, which was originally what the script called for, just totally yelling at her. There was so much yelling in the movie anyway that I thought it might be more intense to try to use my eyes to freak her out and intimidate her. And I just wanted the eyes to keep getting bigger. And Robert Bierman, the director, staged the camera angle so that the camera would move in slowly into my face as my eyes were getting slowly, progressively bigger and bigger and weirder and spookier. So it was, I was pretty happy with that. It was kind of a cool thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to the cockroach eating sequence.
Okay.
There's a scene where you're in your kitchen, and this is after you've decided you're turning into a vampire, and there's a cockroach crawling across the burner of the stove. And
yeah,
you scoop it up in your hand and eat it. Now, we don't see you swallow it in the movie, but we do see you chewing on it. And there's no edit, so it's definitely the real thing that's gone in your mouth,
yeah,
I think.
Definitely the real thing. Originally, they wanted me to eat raw eggs, and that didn't do anything for me.
Sylvester Stallone had already done that.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted to tie in the Renfield thing, you know, Renfield from the Dracula novel where he was eating the bugs and stuff. And
Renfield's always the assistant who's in the insane asylum eating insects.
Right, he's the assistant to Dracula. And it was a slow progression for Peter Lowe. I mean, first he's eating pistachios, then he's eating a cockroach, then he finally eats the dove and ultimately bites a girl's neck and kills her and he drinks her blood. So it was like this progressive building from pistachio to girl. And the cockroach was one of the steps in the disintegration of Peter Lowe. So I said, you know, I want to try eating a cockroach. And everybody was like, you've got to be crazy. And I said, yeah, I know what you mean. I really don't like cockroaches myself. And they wrangled up three New York cockroaches out of somebody's basement. And the day arrived where I had to do it, and I saw the bug when I walked on the set, and the legs were kicking and the antennas were going, and it looked huge. And I almost said, guys, I can't do it. And I figured that would be a cop-out because, you know, I'd set it up and made them wrangle for cockroaches for weeks. I put the cockroach close to me, and every muscle in my body was just saying, don't do it. And the wings were going, and then I did it, and I couldn't sleep for about 3 days, and I couldn't eat, but, well, I did it, and there it is. You know what I mean?
Did you call a doctor first and ask if chewing a cockroach could kill you?
No, yeah, they said it would be okay. What I did was I rinsed my mouth out with 100-proof vodka and sterilized my mouth before I did it. And then when I spat the cockroach out, I sterilized it again.
What did it taste like?
Oh, you know, I couldn't remember. All I know is it was soft. It was not crunchy. It was soft, and it was just a nightmare.
Does it ever come back and haunt you?
Well, when I talk about it like this and I start thinking about it, I get goosebumps. I mean, I'm starting to get the willies again.
Huh. No, but don't you collect exotic insects and animals?
Well, I like exotic fish. I like anything to do with the ocean. And I'm not really a bug fan. I mean, I have a 4-foot perfect, highly detailed model of a wasp in my living room that I stare at on occasion. But I don't really have a huge bug collection, no.
Okay. Nicolas Cage is my guest. Several of your early films were directed by Francis Ford Coppola, who's actually your uncle. Rumblefish, Peggy Sue Got Married, and Cotton Club. You're a Coppola, but you changed your name to Cage. When did you change it, and why did you do it?
Well, when I first started working, I made a couple of TV shows, and I went in to read the other actors for Rumblefish. And by my surprise, they said, well, we'd like you to be in the movie. And, you know, then I was still Nicolas Coppola, and I felt a lot of pressure from the other actors, you know, Mickey and Matt, and basically them thinking I didn't have the goods because I was just a case of nepotism. And it kind of made me a little stiff, you know. I felt a lot of that pressure. So when I changed my name, I felt like I was brand new. I went in to read for a movie called Valley Girl, and it was the first time that I'd auditioned for a movie where the casting lady wasn't talking for a half an hour about the movies that my uncle had made and totally taking my mind off the scene that I had prepared for 2 days, you know? So it really helped me out to change the name, and it took the pressure off of me, and I felt a lot freer.
Why did you choose Cage as your last name?
Well, there's a long time ago, I used to read a lot of comic books, and there was a superhero, and his name was Luke Cage, Power Man. And I just thought it was a cool-sounding name, and then I was listening to John Cage's music, which I found very stimulating, and I just decided to use it. There were a couple other names that I was going to go for, but it just sounded right to me. It was just sort of simple and to the point.
Would you ever change your name back again to Coppola?
You know, I've actually thought about that, but I don't think so. I'm feeling like Nicolas Coppola is a thing of the past, and I'm really comfortable with Cage. So that's the way it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. You have, I've read, a tattoo of a lizard on your back.
Right.
I mean, when you see your back looking in a two-way mirror or something, doesn't it give you the creeps?
No, I that's part of the reason why I put it on my back. I really don't see it that often.
Well, why did you put it there?
Well, it was Halloween 1984, and I broke up with my girlfriend. I was just feeling like I had to do something radical. And when I look back on it, I was 20 years old at the time, and I guess I was getting ready to become a man, and it was like my way of saying, I'm my own person, and I'm breaking free of the family, and I was the first one in the family to get a tattoo. So I guess in retrospect, it was kind of a walkabout, if you will, or a bar mitzvah.
How did you show it to your family?
Well, I remember I just said, Dad, I got a tattoo, and I lifted up my shirt, and he saw it, and his face went white, and he had himself a martini, and that was that.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
My guest has been Nicolas Cage, and he stars in David Lynch's new movie, Wild at Heart, which opens on August 17th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, actress Jamie Lee Curtis. I hope you can join us. That's because you think you're so pretty. And just because your mama thinks you're hot. Well, just because you think you've got something that no other girl has got. You cause me to spend all of my money. You laughed and call me old Santa Claus. Well, I'm telling you, baby, you, because we'll just be equal.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, world music commentator Milo Miles tells us why calypso's gone out of style in the U.S. He's beginning a two-part series on music of Trinidad and Tobago. Also, a talk with actor Bruno Kirby. In the film Good Morning Vietnam, he was a serious, self-righteous lieutenant. He went on to play Billy Crystal's best friend in When Harry Met Sally. Now he's starring with Marlon Brando and Matthew Broderick in the comedy The Freshman. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews the 1950 film Harvey, starring Jimmy Stewart as a man whose best friend is an invisible rabbit. It's now out on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the House and Senate have voted to impose economic sanctions on Iraq. The State Department criticized the action as not helpful to diplomatic efforts, but officials are weighing moves against the Baghdad government as well. Barry Schwide reports.
Both the Senate and House approved sanctions, registering displeasure with Iraq's threats to Israel and to its Arab neighbors. The Senate would cut off more than $1 billion in loan guarantees used to buy American wheat, rice, and other products. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the congressional action would not help the Bush administration. The U.S. ambassador to Baghdad is trying to persuade President Saddam Hussein to ease off. Behind the scenes, however, the administration is considering a requirement for licenses to ship American equipment that could be used in Iraqi nuclear or chemical weapons programs. The requirement effectively would cut off such shipments, and officials said Iraq may be put back on the State Department's terrorism list. That would bar any foreign aid, cut off certain loans, and discourage American firms from operating in Iraq by denying them tax credits. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Also in Washington, the Senate Judiciary Committee has announced that confirmation hearings on the nomination of Judge David Souter to the U.S. Supreme Court will get underway September 13th. President Bush said today that he believes that there is broad support for his nominee and that he will move through the Senate confirmation process with flying colors. Last night on ABC television, Justice Thurgood Marshall said that he had no idea why the president had chosen Souter as his nominee for the High Court, that Justice Marshall had never heard of him. West Berlin officials have arrested a suspect in connection with the 1986 bombing attack on a disco frequented by U.S. servicemen. Deidre Berger reports.
Authorities today say they have arrested a 32-year-old German of Lebanese descent in connection with the 1986 bombing. Three people were killed and more than 200 injured in the explosion. The man denies involvement in the attack. Five other people are being sought in connection with the bombing. Authorities in West Berlin reopened their investigation several weeks ago after new information surfaced in files of the former East German secret police, Stasi. The news magazine Der Spiegel claimed recently the attack was carried out by Middle East terrorists based in East Berlin. The U.S. government has blamed Libya for the attack and bombed Tripoli in 1986 in retaliation for the LaBelle bombing. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 22 points today to close at 2,898.51 on volume of some 149 million shares. Trading was moderate as declining issues led advances 9 to 5. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up, actor Bruno Kirby on playing a scam artist and a jerk. But first, pop music from other countries can thrill American audiences one day and go out of style the next. Take the case of calypso from the West Indies. Until the early 60s, calypsos were regularly imported here and played on the radio. Nowadays, they're rarely heard, except as novelties. In the first of his two-part series on the music of Trinidad and Tobago, world music commentator Milo Miles laments the fate of the always topical calypso.
Take me, I am feeling lonely. Take me down to Los Hero, but don't let me murder no.
Take me, I am feeling lonely. Take me down to Los Hero, but don't let me murder no.
Most people don't know it, but calypso was one of the first forms of black music recorded in the United States. Back in 1912, a New York record company, hoping to open up new markets, auditioned a band from Trinidad. The visitor's name survives only as Lovey's Band, but they left behind this tune called Mango Vert. Calypso was a well-established form by the time it was recorded. It has 19th century roots in two kinds of music played by lower-class blacks during carnival celebrations in Trinidad. The first kind was more danceable and meant to accompany duels with sticks. The second kind was ballads that included boasts, love stories, and comments on local affairs. In the 1880s, the white colonials decided that people were getting just too happy during carnival and banned drums from the parades, which forced changes in the music. By 1900, fans were calling the basic carnival songs Calypso, and by the early 20s, a small but loyal audience for Calypso was established in New York. You can hear echoes of New Orleans jazz in this selection by Sam Manning, which celebrates the sexual adventures of the mongoose, an animal introduced to the islands to kill rats, but which seemed to spend most of its time multiplying like crazy.
Listen to the story why mongoose fled from Jamaica. Listen to the story why mongoose fled from Jamaica. Mongoose and his paper reporter took bed with the preacher's daughter, baptized her in his holy water. Slide a mongoose, slide a mongoose, now your name gone abroad. Slide a mongoose, now your name gone abroad. Mongoose went into Bedford's kitchen, took up one of his father's chicken. That's the reason he fled from Jamaica. Slide a mongoose.
One of the most curious and charming features of Calypso is its obsession with current events. Calypso champions prided themselves on being able to make up songs on the spot about any news topic. Most often, these singing headlines emphasized wit, satire, and subtly subversive jabs at the rich and powerful or business scams. Here's a singer called The Growler complaining about how he was ripped off on a vacation boat ride to Grenada.
I went to Grenada on our excursion. It was the lion that put me in that confusion. I went to Grenada on our excursion. It was the lion that put me in that confusion. When I really thought it was a tourist boat, was a foolish sailing vessel that could hardly float. I had to put a life belt on my head, because the dipping of the sloop nearly killed me dead. Saturday night, we left about 10:30, but the whole of the trip was only misery. While we were traveling on the open seas, the excursionists were suffering bitterly. Women and children with the same refrain, all they were saying, ever me again. A man turned and said to his wife, look, we pay $6 to lose me life.
Calypso is the only really seasonal music style that I know of. You might ask, what, do they only grow them part of the year? But the reason most calypsos are written and recorded from Christmas until March is that they are intended for competition during carnival time. During this period, various performers trot out their latest wares in nightclubs called tents, from the old days when they literally were tents. The crowds vote on the best tunes, and the winner gets to be played during the vast Road March parade, and it picks up hefty extra sales as a sort of souvenir of that year's carnival. Of course, this means that regular winners will have feuds with each other, and a good number of calypsos are put-downs of rivals. This is the celebrated Wilmouth Houdini declaring war on his adversary, Lord Executor.
Cable in the morning, send and tell them I am coming, so they better prepare for war. Cable in the morning, send and tell them I am coming, so they better prepare for war. Tell them murder, kill and slay, war declare at the break of day. On the lion and artillery and the Lord Executor, war declare.
Rounder Records has performed a great service by putting together a sort of Roots of World Music series with two volumes of classic calypsos. The first, called Calypso Pioneers, includes music from 1912 to 1937, and the second, called Calypso Breakaway, covers the years 1927 to 1941. They offer selections by all the performers I've mentioned, as well as other stars, such as The Lion, Lord Beginner, and The Tiger. Calypso has a wonderful directness and immediacy that contradicts its undeserved reputation as an old hat tourist music. It can even be heartrending, like this tale of woe by Lord Executor, who describes his stay in the hospital after an accident that would blind him for the rest of his life.
A new experience that I had gained in a hospital where I was retained. A new experience that I had gained in a hospital where I was retained. By the blow that I received, I went to get cured, and the doctor sent me to the eye ward. As in contemplation I lay among the afflicted on the Christmas day. Thinking I was doing an act of good by helping a woman to chop some wood. When the wood rebonged, I fell to the ground.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for the New York Times and the Village Voice. Next time, he plays us Soca, the contemporary calypso. This is Fresh Air. Remember in Good Morning Vietnam, the humorless officer who was always offering Robin Williams advice on how to be funny? That was my guest Bruno Kirby. He also played Billy Crystal's best friend in When Harry Met Sally, and he was featured in Tin Men, This Is Spinal Tap, Between the Lines, and We're No Angels. Now he's co-starring with Marlon Brando and Matthew Broderick in the new comedy The Freshman. Brando is Carmine Sabatini, a comic turn on his character in The Godfather. Bruno Kirby is his nephew, Vic. As the movie opens, Broderick is leaving his Vermont home to study film at New York University. And when he arrives at Grand Central Station, he falls for a cheap scam. Bruno Kirby offers to drive him to NYU for $10 and drives off with Broderick's luggage and money. A few days later, Broderick sees Kirby on the street, chases after him, and demands to be given his money back.
If you don't give me the money, like, immediately...
Clark, I would love nothing more than to be able to do just that. However, here we run into an awkward moment. Tragically, I suffer from a gambling problem. Right after I left you, I placed a wager on a horse. Predictably.
You lost me money on a horse. All of it.
In retrospect, I'm not sure it actually was a horse.
Oh, God.
When you were preparing to play Vic, did you walk around New York a lot looking for scam artists?
The first thing I did was, when I was doing Tin Men with Danny DeVito, he introduced me to a great guy named Cha-Cha. And Cha-Cha became a friend, and he has a little Italian cafe on Mulberry Street called Cha-Cha's in Boccalupo Cafe. And the minute I got this part, I called up Cha-Cha, and I said, look, here's what I need. Can I come down there with you guys? Can I hang out with you and your friends? Can I see a little bit about what that life down there is like? And Cha-Cha said, sure, come on, forget about it, anything for you. When I went down there, and Cha-Cha isn't a scam artist by any means, but he was able to let me see, you know, he took me where they bought their clothes, he showed me where their loyalty was, he showed me the Chinese restaurants they like to eat at 2 o'clock in the morning, where they like to go gambling. And he was a very big help, and without him and his friend Butchie, then I could have never done it. In terms of scam artists and things like that, I never look for the negatives in my character. I can't play negatives. I don't think people in life, when they get up in the morning, you know, have negative ideas. And I think what Vic says every morning when he gets up is, what can I do today to please the person in the world who I respect and love the most, my Uncle Carmine? What can I do to win his love and respect?
Marlon Brando plays an organized crime head, and everybody comments on his remarkable resemblance to the Godfather in the movie, and there's a lot of Godfather jokes in this movie. Now, you were in Godfather 2, right?
Yeah.
Now, I have to confess to you, I don't remember your part in it. And
well, that's okay. That's a compliment.
Because I wouldn't recognize you in it?
I gained 60 pounds. I had my hairline shaved back. I spoke all Sicilian. I played Clemenza as a young man. When De Niro comes to America, I take him to steal a rug, and I introduce him to a life of crime. So I don't mind that you don't recognize me. To someone who likes to play different characters, that's a good thing.
How come you gained 60 pounds for it?
Well, the character of Clemenza is a very heavy character later on in the film. So I knew that we had to show that stuff starting to happen even in his youth.
See, I've always thought of you as the kind of actor who maybe grows a mustache for a role, you know, but who doesn't, not the kind of actor who puts on 60 pounds for a role.
Well, I do whatever is necessary. I mean, yeah. If you see The Freshman, that's not my hairline. That bald spot isn't mine.
Mm-hmm.
That receding hairline isn't mine. That's stuff I found from hanging out in Little Italy. You know, the character in When Harry Met Sally has a fat pad on at the beginning of the film. People don't even see it. But after he marries Carrie Fisher and she changes his life for the better, I took off the fat pad to show some kind of a, you know, she's made him a better person. She's got him exercising. He's not just sitting around bars at night drinking with the guys. He's doing things.
The movie that I really first started tracking you in, where I first started saying, oh, watch this guy, was Good Morning Vietnam. I don't know why it took me that long, but you played the lieutenant who thinks that Robin Williams should really stick to the Mantovani playlist.
Yes.
Tell me more about what you did to make this character so funny, because I really thought that you were actually one of the funniest things in the movie.
Well, you see, you can't really play a result. So I think the humor, when I approach a character, whether it's a comedy or a drama, I just approach it from their point of view. Now, what makes it funny sometimes is if a person is so sincere about their point of view that they can only see their point of view. So I think that's what gave that character the humor.
Furthermore, you want to stick to playing normal modes of music, not wild stuff. Those we would find acceptable here would include Lawrence Welk, Jim Nabors, Mantovani.
Percy Faith.
Percy Faith, good! Andy Williams, Perry Como, and certain ballads by Mr. Frank Sinatra.
Would Bob Dylan be out of line?
Way, way, way out of line.
You played it as someone who really believes that they're right and
totally
smart and talented.
Totally.
And they really don't get it at all. They have no idea.
They have no idea. And I don't believe that this character woke up every morning and said, today I'm going to be the biggest jerk the United States the United States Army ever produced. I think when he woke up every day and said, I have a great idea. These men are coming back from battle. Let me play soothing music for them.
Your father was an actor, right?
He still is. Great actor, Bruce Kirby.
What roles is he best known for?
Well, he was last seen, he was the head detective in Throw Mama from the Train. The first time around, when Jamie Lee Curtis had her TV series, he played her dad. And we're very, very close. We were born the same day. When I was born, I think my father just said, well, my best friend has arrived. And even though I was a kid, he would take me every place with him. He took me to Lee Strasberg's classes, and he'd say, sit down, just be quiet. He'd come home from work like 2 o'clock in the morning working as a waiter. He'd pick me up. He'd take me to 42nd Street, and we would watch Fellini films and Brando films. I was just a little kid, but we hung out together.
Did you like spending that much time with your father when you were young?
I loved it. It was sensational.
So did this get you excited about movies and about acting?
Well, you know what I think I saw? I looked at these actors, his friends, and I saw the camaraderie. I saw the stories, the way they would kid each other, put each other on. And I think I wanted to be part of it.
Was it helpful to have a father who was an actor, but not a father who was overwhelmingly famous, who you felt that you could never, ever live up to?
Well, I wouldn't know about the second part of it because, you know, I consider my dad... My dad, to me, knows more about acting than anybody I've ever met. He knows more about my acting than anyone. I mean, I remember when I was getting ready to do Good Morning Vietnam, I always give him my scripts, and we always talk about my roles. I give him the Good Morning Vietnam script, and we're going to shoot the film in Bangkok. So I go by his house to say, you know, to go over the script a little bit, but basically to say goodbye. It's the day before I leave. And I'm kind of running, you know, that kind of place you get when you're thinking about a trip, and he's talking to me about the character, and I'm just shaking my head, yes, 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 yes. And he says, okay, goodbye. I say, goodbye, Dad, I love you. And I start to leave, and he goes, wait, 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 Bruno, one more thing. I said, yeah, Dad, what is it? He said, you know, I think this is the kind of character who would send jokes to Reader's Digest. And I said, yeah, okay, take care, I love you, goodbye. And I find myself on the set with Barry Levinson. And I say, you know, Barry, I just want to say something here. I just want to say that, tell Robin that Reader's Digest is publishing two of my jokes. And Barry, because he's got his own kind of genius, says, okay, but they're just considering publishing two of your jokes.
Do you often do that, by the way, add things to a character?
Yeah, constantly.
What's an example of something you added in The Freshman?
In The Freshman? Wow, let's see. Oh, I know some stuff that we added. Marlon is so facile. He has this thing where he starts, when the kid sits down, he says, you want a nut? And the kid says, no. I say, none for me, Uncle Carmine. And he says, you want some coffee to the kid? I say, none for me, Uncle Carmine. Well, that stuff, that part of the relationship wasn't scripted. In other words, we didn't know Marlon was going to offer him a nut, but I just instinctively knew that if I acted as if he was offering something to me too, that Marlon would totally ignore me, and it would give the character a different kind of shading. And that's one of the things that just kind of happened as we were shooting.
Do you have one of your earlier films that you wish were better known now because you really liked your performance in it?
I liked my performance in a film called Texas Legend, but they changed the title to Kiss My Grits. They did this to see if they could get me to kill myself, but it was one of the most painful experiences I've ever had in my life. I did this movie. It was produced by Tony Quinn. It was Bruce Davison was in the movie. He did a wonderful job. And I played a sheep herder from Texas. So I went down to Texas, and I worked on a sheep ranch. And he was just a good old boy, and he fell in love with this girl who didn't really care about him at all. And I thought I did a lot of wonderful work. But the company who released the film ended up doing a drawing in Variety of Bruce Davison and myself with our pants dropped, looking over our shoulders, saying, kiss our grits. And the film was one of those films that shows up at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And it's, I'm sorry that I wasn't able to do, that character someplace else where more people might have seen him. But otherwise, I don't have too many regrets.
Another question about The Freshman. When you were playing scenes with Brando, did it take a while before you stopped feeling intimidated? Did you feel intimidated
No,
at all?
No, not at all. He takes that right away from you. The first time I met him, I was waiting for him to come to rehearsal at Andy Bergman's. We're waiting. Matthew's getting a little edgy. Penelope Ann Miller's getting a little edgy because you're meeting Marlon Brando. You can't deny that. And he walks in and he looks at me and he says, the last time I saw you, you had on a brown derby and a long coat and you were stealing a rug. Come here. And he gives me this hug. And basically what he's doing is he's absorbing all of my tension into himself. And 5 minutes later, you turn around and you're sitting around this table and you're working with somebody who I think is as good as it gets, and you're totally relaxed because of him.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Actor Bruno Kirby, this is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we have a report by Michelle Trudeau, a profile of B.F. Skinner, the leading light of behavioral psychology. Also, a talk with Charles Lindholm, who's written a book about charisma. We'll hear from Scott Simon, who this week is taking a break from usual duties to report on the Marion Barry trial as the defense has rested its case there. And also, we'll hear a bit from a man who knows several Supreme Court justices, a side of them that we usually don't see, and that's their feet.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The 1950 film Harvey is one of this summer's new home video releases. Critic Owen Gleiberman has an unusual slant on it.
Harvey, in which Jimmy Stewart carries on conversations with an imaginary 6-foot-tall rabbit, remains a goofball classic. Stewart never played another character quite like Elwood P. Dowd, the wealthy eccentric who spends his days wandering through town, stopping into pubs, and offering heartfelt dinner invitations to anyone who speak to him for more than 12 seconds. Elwood is a harmless, lovable flake. Yet the way Stewart plays him, he's a man with the courage of his own dementia. You can tell why this remains one of Stewart's favorite characters. It gave him a chance to parody himself. He plays Elwood with his usual aw shucks friendliness, only now that all-American smile stays plastered in place for a few extra seconds. It's the sort of inexplicably blissed-out look you find on the faces of game show hosts and mass murderers. The weirdest thing about Elwood isn't that he thinks he's friends with a giant rabbit. It's that it never occurs to him Harvey isn't visible to the rest of the world, too.
And now, Aunt Ethel, I'd like you to meet Harvey. Harvey, you've heard me speak of Aunt Ethel Chauvenet. She's one of my oldest and dearest friends. She's the one who... Hmm? That's right. Well, this is the one. No, no, she's the one. He says he would have known you anywhere.
Well, Harvey has some of the casual nuttiness of a Preston Sturges comedy. As the movie goes on, there are hints that Harvey may not be a fantasy bunny after all, and that Elwood truly holds the mystical key to life. This is the original Crazy People Are Saner Than the Rest of Us movie. What gives Harvey its slightly subversive edge is that Elwood's madness has a not-so-mystical inspiration. He's an incredible lush who, on an average night out, consumes enough martinis to knock Nick and Nora Charles to the floor. That's one of the main reasons he likes having Harvey around. He can always order two drinks at a time.
Well, Harvey and I sit in the bars and have a drink or two, play the jukebox. And soon the faces of all the other people, they turn toward mine and they smile. And they're saying, we don't know your name, mister, but you're a very nice fellow. Harvey and I warm ourselves in all these golden moments. We've entered as strangers. Soon we have friends, and they come over and they sit with us, they drink with us, they talk to us. They tell about the big, terrible things they've done and the big, wonderful things they'll do, their hopes and their regrets, their loves and their hates, all very large, because nobody ever brings anything small into a bar.
Watching Harvey, you keep waiting for the movie to come down on Elwood's drinking. Only it never does. Elwood's relatives are stuffy Victorian types who want to commit him to a mental institution. In effect, he's the rock and roller of the family. The movie was made exactly 40 years ago, and its harmless view of alcoholism now seems inconceivably quaint. Yet that's part of its genial charm. Can you imagine what would happen if they did a remake of Harvey? It would probably star Wilford Brimley and end with Elwood going into detox. This era of health and therapy has certainly been good for our bodies and souls, but maybe not so much for our movies.
Owen Gleiberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Naomi Person produces the reviews and commentaries on Fresh Air. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy and Russ Anbucci. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
She used to be known as the Queen of Scream. Now she's best known for comedy roles. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Jamie Lee Curtis. Also, we speak with novelist and Vietnam veteran Tim O'Brien. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Corporation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and National Public Radio. Hi, I'm Marion McPartland. My guest today is Onaje Allen Gums. He's a most talented musician who composes and plays his own songs, and they're very beautiful and very evocative. They really touch your heart, and I think anyone can relate to them. Now, is this what you strive for?